You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news in technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, do you enjoy listening to Kick-Ass News? Well, then become a part of what I'm doing here and help support the show by going to patreon.com/kickassnews and making a donation. Your encouragement and support is always appreciated. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. Folks, I've gotten a few emails and complaints on social media that I'm not giving enough airtime to supporters of Donald Trump. So today, I'm having a guest who is probably the biggest pro-Trumper in the media, Ann Coulter, who has a new bestseller called In Trump We Trust, E Pluribus Awesome. And I'll warn you, if you're getting tired of hearing me talk about Donald Trump, this may not be the week for you. Because later in the week, I'll give equal time to the other side with a journalist named David K. Johnston, who also has a new bestseller about Trump, which takes a decidedly different position on the man he covered for 30 years for the New York Times. But first today, I'm delighted to finally welcome her on the show. She's the woman conservatives love and liberals love to hate, political columnist, author, and pundit, Ann Coulter. Prior to becoming an opinion writer, Ann Coulter had a career in law. After graduating from the University of Michigan Law School, Coulter clerked for Judge Pasco Bowman II in the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals and then worked in private practice in New York City. Coulter later worked as a legal staffer for the Senate Judiciary Committee, where she handled crime and immigration issues for Senator Spencer Abraham. From there, she became a litigator for the Center for Individual Rights. After advising the legal team in Paula Jones' suit against then-President Bill Clinton, Ann Coulter wrote her first book, High Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Case Against Bill Clinton, which made it to number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction in 1998. She followed it up in 2002 with her second book, Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right, which made it to number 1 on the nonfiction bestseller list. All told, she's had a dozen New York Times bestsellers, including last year's book, Adios America, The Left's Plan to Turn Our Country into a Third World Hellhole, and her newest book, In Trump We Trust. Coulter is a legal correspondent for Human Events magazine. She writes a popular nationally syndicated column, and she's a frequent guest on Hannity, Red Eye, Real Time with Bill Maher, Fox & Friends, The O'Reilly Factor, The Today Show, and Good Morning America. In her latest addition to the bestseller list, Ann Coulter says Donald Trump is, quote, a one-man wrecking ball against our dysfunctional and corrupt establishment, and she encourages Americans to join the revolution. And while she may not have won me over to the revolution, I hope you'll hear her out, because she's not blind to Trump's personality flaws, and she has and does call him out when he crosses a line or waffles on her key issues. But more importantly, I think she gives the best explanation of the whole Trump phenomenon that I've heard so far. And it's probably not what you're hearing from either the mainstream media or the conservative media. Today, she makes the case for why Trump is uniquely suited to take on the political establishment, why he can get away with addressing issues that no one in Washington seems to want to talk about, and how he may finally be the one to propel the Republican Party out of the Reagan era. We talk about Trump's meeting last week with Mexican President Nieto and his recent flirtation with softening his stance on deportation. And then she answers questions from you, the listeners, including, is she a lizard person? Coming up with Ann Coulter in just a moment. I'm joined over the phone today by that shrinking violet Ann Coulter. She is a sought-after lecturer, nationally syndicated columnist, and the author of 12 and now, I believe, 13 New York Times bestsellers. She has a new book called Emily Post's Essential Guide to Modern Etiquette. I'm, of course, kidding. It's called In Trump We Trust, E Pluribus Awesome. Ann, thanks for calling in.
Just to be fair, since I would definitely correct you if you got it wrong the other way, this is the number 12th New York Times bestseller.
Ah, okay. Fantastic.
I get confused myself on how many I've written, though my friends were reminding me last night that at least after the first couple of books, every book I write, I say, okay, that's it. I got no more books in me.
Well, simply because there's been so much speculation about the pro-Trump media's agenda, and now Ailes and Bannon are on the campaign, I have to ask, do you have any affiliation with the Trump campaign?
No, I'm just a groupie.
Okay.
I'm a fan.
Okay.
And Mr. Trump follows me on Twitter. It's a very important Twitter feed.
Well, that's an exclusive list. I think there are probably less than 30 people that he follows on Twitter or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's me and Barron.
You and Barron, I love it. So there's no secret deal for you to have a show on his 24-hour Trump news network after the election, right?
No, and I don't think he's going to. I would love a network that is not totally in the tank for open borders. I think it's a great idea, and a wealthy person could make a lot of money doing that. But I do think Trump is going to be the next president, so he won't have time for a TV network.
Well, you know, I enjoyed the book. I have to say, I don't want to say I'm never Trump. You know, maybe he'll surprise me. I don't want to draw any lines in the sand, because that's always how I get my face pushed in the sand eventually, inevitably. But I'm hesitant about Trump, and I will give you credit for this much. This book gives the best real explanation for the Trump phenomenon that I've heard yet. You know, the media loves to say that, you know, it's all just because of his celebrity or white nationalism or reality TV culture, general anger at the establishment. But, you know, to paraphrase Carville, I think that you probably could have just as easily titled this book, It's Immigration, Stupid. Is that what we're missing here? Is it really that simple?
The media has been missing it for such a long time. We're slowly getting, 1 year into this, we're getting, you know, slow, grudging admissions that, maybe people aren't wild about immigration. But I'm so glad that you told me that and that you've read my book, because it was really written with people like you in mind, because, I understand the hesitancy. If you had asked me about Donald Trump before that blockbuster opening speech, I probably would have said a lot of the things the Never Trumpers are saying now. Come on, he's tacky, he's coarse, you can't be serious. He's never run for political office. It really was completely his issues. And I do think now watching him, as I describe in the book, a lot of things that I thought were not only disadvantages, but kind of embarrassing about him, turn out to be huge advantages. I mean, when you see, he's really pulled back the curtain on the elites and their demand for a never-ending supply of cheap labor, and for the Democrats, a never-ending supply of basically automatic Democratic votes. But I'm more concerned about, you know, the overall country and our working class, and not just both political parties working to help Wall Street and the corporate owners. And it really exposed even my party. I always thought, I kind of knew the Democrats didn't really care about the working class. They'd give it you know, a little lip service and then get into office and say, well, what do you need, Wall Street? But I thought my party cared about regular, ordinary Americans. And then Trump comes along and says, we have to stop this. We have to do something for our working class, for the manufacturing base in the country. And he gets this furious reaction, not just to the gold fixtures, which I would totally get rid of, but to his actual policy proposals. That's what I think people are voting on. That's what the enthusiasm is about. It's not, I've never seen his reality TV show. I never really thought about him very much. It's what his issues are, and it really is a lot, it's between him and the people, all the rallies and the Twitter feed. I mean, he slightly will change his message, not change his message, but stress different parts of his message, depending on, I mean, applause, but by applause, I mean more the metaphorical applause. He has a sense for what America is dying to hear. You know, better trade deals, stop dumping poor people on our country, put our interests first, save Social Security by not giving it to immigrants, and so on and so forth. It really is a very issue-based campaign.
Yeah, and in there you say that you've yet to meet someone who says that they disagree with Trump on the issues. I just like his personality. And that does definitely runs counter to this whole narrative of his supporters as a personality cult.
Absolutely. Oh, my gosh. I mean, and that's when it occurred to me, because I kept thinking at first, oh, my gosh, he's saying everything. He's pushing all the right issues, but why couldn't he be Mitt Romney? And as soon as that thought enters your head, you realize why it couldn't be Mitt Romney. By pushing issues for ordinary Americans and not serving the elites, by which I mean to include the media, the donors to both political parties, the attacks on him were and continue to be. They're even worse now. It's just the daily slander on Trump. And you know, Romney couldn't have taken 2 minutes of this abuse. I kept waiting for Trump to back down the first 2 weeks. I must say, I did not completely take him seriously for the first 2 weeks. I loved his issues. I thought those were the winning issues. But it took a few weeks for me to see, oh my gosh, he's not backing down.
Yeah, and based on your last bestseller, Adios America, immigration has been your issue for the past year or more. So was that what convinced you?
I was doing some research on Nexus, and it's been my issue since 2006. It was hard to get out because every single network, including Fox News, as this report in, I think it was today's Observer, I was just reading it about, you know, the downfall of Roger Ailes, but it gets into a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. A lot of my friends were emailing me because I've been telling them forever, Murdoch, Fox News, Wall Street Journal, they are totally for open borders. This is so dangerous that people see Fox News as the, quote, conservative network when, yes, they are on everything except one issue, the most important issue facing the country. So it may not be as obvious as ISIS or something, and or the Iraq War, what my positions were on other issues. But I was randomly coming across interviews I was doing. It was when George Bush first pushed amnesty that I thought, oh my gosh, what are you doing? And after that, we could be talking about the Commerce Secretary, and somehow I would slip in something on immigration.
Yeah, and it's strange timing because, you know, Ryan Priebus, the chairman of the RNC, was desperately trying to avoid this issue coming into this campaign. And after he had done the whole autopsy after 2012, is he wrong about that? Was this not a major issue in why Romney lost in 2012?
I think, well, I mean, as I say at the beginning of the book, we're going to find out. Maybe the Democrats have had enough time to bring in, I mean, since Teddy Kennedy's 1965 Immigration Act, that has completely switched the sort of immigrant we get. So pre-1970 immigrants were, as you would expect all immigrants to any country to be, were better than us. They were more highly educated. They bought more property. And actually, long before that, the turn of the century immigrants, about a third of them went home. So that's how we ended up with the creme de la creme from around the world. Post-1970 immigrants, under the Kennedy Immigration Act, it completely changed the rules so that we were getting 90% of our immigrants suddenly from from cultures as different from ours as exist on Earth. Mm-hmm. 90% from the third world. The majority end up going on government assistance, and 8 out of 10 voting for the Democrats. So it's been great for the Democrats. It's interesting to see people like, you know, Harry Reid, Bill Clinton, Jesse Jackson, Bernie Sanders, up until he ran for president, ferociously against this mass immigration of low-skilled workers because it hurts our own low-skilled workers. But then the Democrats figured out, oh, but they're voting for us. I guess we don't care about our own low-skilled workers anymore. This has been this has been a big issue for a long time. And the Republicans, if anything, I think Romney lost by not pushing immigration. He did during the primaries. He basically dropped it like a hot potato when he got the nomination.
You make a good point in here that I hadn't really thought about. You say that Americans are the only ones who aren't allowed to be nostalgic for the things that define our home. People always complain that we're the ugly Americans when we travel abroad and we tread all over everyone else's cultures. And yet you point out that essentially we're not allowed to have that same type of pride in American culture.
Right. This is an effort by people who hate this country. They'll love America as soon as it's not America anymore. And by bringing in people from such divergent cultures, and as Trump highlighted in his immigration speech this week, you know, why shouldn't we ask that immigrants coming to this country will love us and love our values and will be financially self-sufficient? It's hilarious to see some of the reaction in the media. How dare you? Why, this is an outrage. Of course, any country should demand that. But we are changing the American way of life and what America is. Yes, America is very, it's a warm, generous country. We can assimilate lots of different people from different cultures. But the numbers coming in, it's basically become a hate crime to even ask immigrants to assimilate. But it also is much harder, virtually impossible, I'd say, because of the vast numbers coming in from, you know, Bangladesh, Somali, from Vietnam. We have all the Hmong communities, obviously from Latin America. Our largest group of legal immigrants come from one country, from Mexico. We've already taken 1/4 of Mexico's population. You know, at what point are we, quote, diverse enough when we've taken every last Mexican into the country? Do we need the whole population? Is it half of it? This is fundamentally transforming America into some other country, and the people who are going to suffer the most are women, children, plants, animals, the most vulnerable Americans. Great for the super rich. They have lots of cheap labor, and it's not their emergency rooms that are being overrun. Not their schools that have to cancel other programs because it's all being spent on English as a second language. But it's massively transforming America, and we're supposed to be embarrassed about just saying they're the ones changing it. Never has a country decided to transform itself into another country like this. It's not like, you know, Japan says, hey, let's become Scotland. We are being changed, and those of us who say, wait, but we liked America, including immigrants, I might add. They did come to America. They didn't decide to go to Guatemala or Bangladesh.
True.
We're the ones who are being called the racists. Well, I think the burden is on the people who are transforming this country into a different country to explain why.
What did you think about Trump's meeting with the president of Mexico? Was that a win for him?
Oh, my gosh, it was fantastic. I tweeted out at the time, I think he could, you know, cancel that immigration speech and just start planning his transition team. It reminds everyone what one of the many things that I think actually is really great about Trump is that he has been a businessman his whole life and obviously is a very good negotiator. He's made a lot of money. People who have negotiated both on his side and against him say that he's very good, fair, but, you know, everybody ends up happy. And I think you saw some of that on display, but also just the way he instantly accepted, took command. I loved when the press was there and they asked if they could take questions. It's Trump. It's not the guy who's hosting the meeting. Trump decides, yes, we'll take a few questions, and then starts calling on reporters.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Ann Coulter. when we come back in just a moment. If you're enjoying my conversation with Ann Coulter, then get her best-selling book, In Trump We Trust, E Pluribus Awesome. And right now, you can download the audio version of her book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be In Trump We Trust by my guest today, Ann Coulter, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews, or click the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. The other day, he seemed to walk back his statements about deporting illegals. Did that give you pause?
Yes, I hysterically denounced him on Twitter, but I've done that before. He's my guy, but I will criticize him when he gets things wrong. He did in one of the debates on H-1B visas. I wasn't wild about that retweet he sent of the unattractive picture of Heidi Cruz. But, you know, these are constructive criticisms I'm giving. And I think that all that drip, drip, drip about the softening, and I describe some incidents like this in my book, I think he's a much more brilliant strategist than many people are giving him credit for. I mean, look at what that whole, the whole sort of hinting at the softening led to. He accomplished three major objectives. Number one, and most importantly, since the convention, Trump has been giving speech after speech every day. I've watched not all of them, but a lot of them online. And oh my gosh, they are fantastic. I will criticize Trump when I think he's done something wrong. Since the convention, these speeches, there is not a syllable I would change. Just fantastic speeches. And I kept noticing when I'd watch one, sometimes online, I think there was one they showed on TV, I kept noticing, why isn't the media showing these speeches? You don't see Trump speaking himself. What you see is commentators saying, oh, it was awful, it was mean, it was dark, it was ugly, you don't want to see it, trust us viewers. So for one thing, he tricked every cable news station into showing one of the most important speeches, one of the greatest speeches I've ever seen, fully live, gavel to gavel, as the expression goes, including those angel moms. And he has the angel moms, the mothers and fathers of children who have been murdered by illegal aliens. A lot of them come on stage at his events. Trump tricked all three networks into covering his speech, tricked them into showing the angel moms because they're waiting for the, you know, softening. So that's one huge thing he accomplished. That's the most important thing he accomplished because the media is being so unfair to him. The second thing he accomplished was any of his advisors whom we've been hearing, you know, and who knows if it's true, so I'm not necessarily blaming these people. I'm just saying what's been reported, whether it's Kellyanne Conway, which I kind of doubt, who is pushing the softening, Rudy Giuliani, Chris Christie, right. Roger Ailes, Sean Hannity, you know, all of them supported the Gang of Eight amnesty, right. And there are stories that they've been pushing him, oh, you got to soften to get the soccer moms, get the soccer moms. So the second thing he accomplished is he floats this as a trial balloon, and I think the grassroots responded, and responded okay. Thunderously, so he can turn to them now and say, okay, enough of the softening. And the third and final thing he accomplished, which I, of course, think was at the top of his agenda, was he totally helped promote my book. The only time the media right. notices I exist is when I have, you know, the slightest constructive criticism for him.
Given the fact that he does sometimes play both sides of issues, were you at all hesitant about committing yourself to the book title, In Trump We Trust?
I thought it was a fun title, and it made me laugh. And that's how I decide okay. things. Does it make me laugh? It sounds Trumpian.
Okay, but you know that they're going to beat you over the head with that title.
I like it. It's hard to beat someone with something that's funny.
How about the self-financing? Because you talk about that in the book yeah. as one of the best assurances that he was going to do what he said and not be owned by anyone. Do you worry now that he might be beholden to the donor class now that he's taking donations?
Not really. I mean, this is pushing issues that are important and popular and winning lots of voters. That's how you win elections. This is what has gotten him where he is. And the other thing I've sort of noticed since Trump came along, and I say this in the chapter on, I think it's chapter 3 on the consultants and the donors, the Washington insiders, I hate with the hot hate of a thousand suns. They don't care about the country. They care about their jobs and their kids' college tuitions. They are going to fight Trump tooth and nail because this is existential for them. The plutocrats, on the other hand, are a mixed bag. I think a lot of them, even though I've always made fun of them and disputed this, I think a lot of them are actually totally patriotic and love the country, but they're busy doing whatever it is they do that makes them millions and sometimes billions of dollars. So the reason they were giving so much money to consultants was because they wanted some Republican to win, and the consultants would come to them and say, trust us, we know what we're doing. We're not going to let the candidate talk about immigration. That will destroy the candidacy. Some of them, yes, wanted cheap labor, but by and large, I think a lot of the billionaires are sitting back thinking, wow, we were had. Stuart Stevens and Mike Murphy have no idea what they're talking about, and we can save a lot of money now. Now, there are some of the plutocrat big donors really are in it just for themselves, and we're going to find out who they are right now. If all they ever cared about was getting their own taxes cut and getting their own cheap labor, well, okay, they can vote for Hillary. They're gone. Good riddance.
If there's one group that you give it to more than the donors, it's the whole consultant class in D.C. And you take on the polls saying that opinion data collection is a modern-day version of voodoo. Let me ask you, though, in the past two presidential elections, many of these polls were way off, but they were off in that they overestimated the Republican vote, and the election, it didn't end up being as tight as they predicted. Does that bode poorly for Trump in 2016?
Well, generally, the opinion collection polls I'm talking about aren't something just simple like, who are you going to vote for?
Okay.
When it's just, you know, a question like that, it's more... Where you get the fakery is on the immigration polls. 100% of the immigration polls are big, fat lies. For one thing, just to describe briefly, whenever Americans are polled on a path to legalization, it's always loaded up with hoops that the illegals will allegedly have to vote for, learn English, pay back taxes, rigorous vetting, all of which is a lie. So, you know, just tell us the truth on the poll. And I would actually prefer not to talk about the immigrants themselves at all. Questions like, do you think illegal immigrants contribute to society? Because there you're pulling a sneaky trick. Americans are really nice people, and they don't want to insult anyone. How about not mentioning the immigrants, but just say, should there be more or less immigration?
Okay. So
you're
saying
that
okay. So it's more like push polls that you don't trust so much.
Yes, exactly. So I am not saying I disbelieve the polls. I think generally, what you say is definitely true in the 2012 election. But I think because it showed them tied, and that's why the night before the election I thought Romney was going to win, because when it's tied, usually the incumbent loses. Thought there might be some of a Bradley effect and so on and so forth. But I think, I'm not sure, but I suspect that Hurricane Katrina probably and the whole Chris Christie thing was
probably a
last-minute thing that may have skewed the polls. I think the polls will start to change. I still think Donald Trump, I mean, not a slam dunk like I did for the nomination, but I think he's more likely to win than to lose. I think the polls will change. And at this stage, well, I guess we'll see what happens, but I still think he's more likely to win than to lose. And also I'd say, I mean, I probably shouldn't even say this right now, but the media, I've never seen the media like this. I've read about the McCarthy era, the Goldwater era, the Nixon era. It's unbelievable. Would I put it past the media to be running, to be, you know, sort of biasing their polls? Especially this far out, in order to discourage Trump voters, I wouldn't put it past them. Now, as it gets closer, they don't want to embarrass themselves.
Yeah, and I do want to say this. I will give him credit. He is saying a lot of things that I've been wanting someone in the GOP to say for a long time. I kind of just wish there was a better messenger, but
evangelicals. That's why my book is addressed to people like you.
Well,
that's what I thought too.
But you know, but you do point out, you know, you say that Republicans have been getting a little too evangelical-y lately.
Uh-huh. I'm an evangelical, but I don't need my presidential candidate having raptures on stage.
Yeah, I mean, have the Ralph Reeds and the Jerry Falwell Jr.'s been allowed to get a little too much clout over the past 10 to 20 years?
I swear, I think even Jerry Falwell Jr. is sitting back saying, come on, knock it off. We don't need you speaking tongues on stage. I mean, Jerry Falwell Jr. endorsed Donald Trump.
Right.
The, you know, twice divorced, Fifth Avenue living, model marrying.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing, I guess, is he doesn't drink, but there's actually nothing wrong with drinking in the Bible. It was Christ's first miracle.
Right. Well, you know, the other thing that you point out, which I've been saying for a while, I enjoyed the chapter where you talk about the GOP Reagan mimicry. And with Trump, you know, here we are 35 years later. Are we finally entering the post-Reagan era of the Republican Party now?
No, and also, as I point out, they don't remember Reagan. This one of the things, oh my gosh, this has driven me crazy for such a long time. This optimism meme they have. I mean, they're buying into the liberal media's caricature of Reagan. But it's much like with Trump, that, oh, it has nothing to do with the issues. It's not, that's not what people care about with Reagan. He just seems like granddad, and he's passing out candy to little kids and that goofy optimism. It was his personality, people like. No, it wasn't. As with Trump, it was his personality. But moreover, and I went back and well, as you know from the book, but I did some general nexus searches about the way Reagan talked and then quoted from his one debate with Jimmy Carter. Whatever the opposite of optimistic is, was Ronald Reagan in that debate. I take about 8 quotes from that debate, talking about our crumbling inner cities and, you know, the bad trade deals. And if something isn't changed, it's lights out for America. It was incredibly, quote, dark and pessimistic. Reagan only got optimistic after he had been president.
Yeah, and you also say that we need to cool it with all of this Cold War rhetoric.
Yes! It's so just like they want to go fight the Indians again. This happy trigger finger for the Soviet Union. Look, I don't think I'd want to live in Russia right now, but it's not the Soviet Union. It's not a huge threat. I do not think there is. I think there are more transgenders in America than there are Americans worried about Putin going into Ukraine.
At the end of the book, you say that the GOP either will follow his lead and end up a better, stronger party, or it will go the way of the Whigs. Now, does that still hold true if he loses?
I have trouble thinking, yes, but I have trouble even conceiving of it because I kind of thought the country might be over when Romney lost. We are so close to the tipping point on the demographic changes to this country. And I thought, okay, that's it. They did it. They had time to change the country. Republicans can't win another election nationwide. We're in another 10 years, we'll have 9 Ruth Bader Ginsburgs on the Supreme Court, and the Republican Party will just be wiped out. And it won't even be the Charles Rangel Democratic Party versus the Nancy Pelosi Democratic Party. It will be, as it is in California and as it is in all multicultural societies, the Hispanic Democrats against the Asian Democrats against the Muslim Democrats. Suddenly people start voting on ethnic lines. Well, all people except white Americans. Nobody harangues us and says, you're a traitor to your race for voting for the Democrats. No, long-standing traditional Americans, they actually look at the issues and vote on that most of the time. So, you know, we're so close to the tipping point now. I think Trump is the only hope to save the country, and then we can argue about everything else. But if Hillary is elected, I mean, she has already vowed to grant blanket amnesty across the board to all illegal aliens here, and it is not 11 million, it's 30 to 60 million, we don't even know, but it is minimum 30 million illegals here. She's going to more than quadruple the number of Muslim refugees she's bringing in. I mean, that we already have Obama flying in, to this day, quote, refugees that don't meet any definition of refugee from Central America, placing them in the states that the Democrats need to flip from red to blue. Republicans will have no chance. They will be wiped out. And like I say, it'll be the Hispanic Democrats against the Asian Democrats. It'll be a transformed country, so there's really no point. And then I stop caring about politics and start writing mysteries.
There you go. Well, before we wrap up, I threw it out to listeners on social media to send in some questions, so I'll just wrap up with one or two of those. Audrey asked, and I hear this from a lot of liberals, how much of this do you actually believe? Are you just trolling America? Is it all for money?
I don't know why liberals find it comforting to think that this is an act. I'm whooping their butts. I've had 12 New York Times bestsellers. If this is an act, think of what I could do when I actually believe something. And the making money thing, no, there are a lot easier ways to make money than going and attacking all the elites and the powers that be. I know, I'll start writing books attacking the media, academia, Hollywood, all the powerful political players. I'll be a millionaire by noon.
Yeah, and it's funny because I hear this from liberals all the time. They'll wish a painful death on Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh or Drudge, but they seem to be a little gentler on you because somehow they've created this narrative where Ann Coulter doesn't really believe all this and she's just saying things to get a rise out of people. Does that bug you when they say that you don't believe what you say?
No, I can still kick their butts. It shows what weaklings they are. But if this is them going gentler on me, I'm not sure about it. I think you may be wrong there. It reminded me of the chapter in my book on Trump isn't giving policy specifics. It's when he's the only one, as I describe, interspersing that with, you know, headlines and his detailed policy papers, and contrasting him with other politicians. You know, I never realized how much I hate my party until Trump came along. But I really just hate all politicians. They have this art, which thankfully Trump doesn't have, and I can't imagine if he ever learned it, he'd want to, of not answering a question. What they do is restate what the question was. But they'll never tell you what their plan is. Whereas, you know, right. What are you going to do about illegal immigration? People are frustrated. Trump says, I'm going to build a wall. And so it was so weird. Every time I walk into the kitchen, I have news on all the time, so when I'm making my coffee or dinner, whatever, I'm listening to it. It was always, well, he has no policy specifics. He just said, is he going to give us some specifics? What are his policies? And I think it's the same thing with this is just an act. They feel like they need to say something. Words must be coming out of their mouths, and they should probably form sentences with a subject and a verb. But they can't actually respond to what I'm saying. They can't respond to what Trump is saying. So with Trump, it's no policy specifics. With me, it's, oh, that's just an act. This is, okay, you have words coming out of your mouth, but it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and you do make a good point in there that no one remembers what any of the other Republican candidates' policies were on trade or immigration or just about anything.
Right. It was all, we need a disruptor to go to Washington.
Right.
I'm a constructive conservative. I've got an optimistic message. But what are you going to do?
Well, we'll close with a quick question from Bob, who says, are you really a lizard person?
I'm a lizard person?
A lizard person.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Oh, that's
it.
You don't know about
that?
This is the crazy conspiracy. This is the conspiracy that the New World Order is run by, I guess, lizards like V. Remember V? The whole miniseries.
I hope you have some sane listeners, Lamb Chop, or I have just wasted a half an hour. If this is the tenor of most of the, I have said
tongue in cheek. I hope so. Yeah, no, but there's this whole conspiracy of, I guess, that there are some people in high office who are secretly lizard, giant lizard people who look like humans. So I don't know why, but now you know. See, this, you learned something.
And their vote counts as much as ours.
Exactly. Well, again, the book is called In Trump We Trust, E Pluribus Awesome. Ann Coulter, thanks so much for calling in and joining me to talk about it.
Absolutely. Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Ann Coulter for coming on the show. And if you enjoyed today's episode, then order her new bestseller, In Trump We Trust, E Pluribus Awesome. I'll include an Amazon link where you can order it in the show notes for this episode and on our website at kickassnewspodcast.com. Or if you'd prefer to listen to the audio version, you can download that for free through that special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Her nationally syndicated column can be found in many newspapers across the country every week. You can also read it at townhall.com or on her website at anncoulter.com. And follow her on Twitter at @anncoulter. And if you found today's podcast interesting, then download the next episode later this week when I talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston about his new bestseller, The Making of Donald Trump. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews. Or if you prefer, you can set up a recurring monthly contribution at patreon.com/kickassnews. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to all your friends on your social media. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnewspodcast.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.